helps because it can introduce what I want to say. About 20 years ago, I went on holiday with a family in an old, rickety old house in Scotland. And one day, two children came to me and they said, "Come and play hide and seek." You don't refuse two children who ask you to play hide and seek. But I had a big problem. It was late afternoon, and I was supposed to have done my half hour of mental prayer. I hadn't done it. So the problem was, how do you do your mental prayer as you play hide and seek? That's the story. It used to be entitled Theology for the 11 Minus. In our country, there used to be an exam called the 11 Plus. When you were 11, you took this examination. If you were very clever, you went to a school for very clever people. If you were a little less clever, you went to another school. So I gave these talks the title Theology for the 11 Minus. Because if you were very clever, then you had no business listening to my talks. And I used to give these talks to adolescents and people. On a Saturday night, I'd fill my house with young people. And then this was the stories I told them. Somebody typed them up. And then, because I was so deeply convinced that one has to learn how to communicate with the new media, that a friend of mine who already done some work with me, a video on some saints, said, "Let's do a video on this." The title 11 Minus, Theology of 11 Minus, didn't work because the examination was abolished years ago. So that ruined my title. So I had to find another one. And one day, this introduces me to the talk, one day I was thinking about the caucus race in Alice in Wonderland. I have to assume you all have some idea about Alice in Wonderland. And if you remember, they all get very wet and they don't know how to get dry. So what happens is that the mouse says, "I will give a lecture," and then everybody will get dry. The mouse gave a lecture. And the mouse was trying to be learned. And when people are trying to be learned, then they can be very boring. So the dodo said, "That's no good. Let's have a caucus race." And Alice and the others said, "What is a caucus race?" To which the dodo said, "The best way to explain it is to do it." Now hang on to that phrase. The best way to explain it is to do it. So the caucus race was started. You started when you wanted, and you just went round and round. And finally the dodo would say, "The race is over." So they all stopped. And Alice said, "Who's won?" And the dodo thought that was an extraordinarily stupid question. Everybody's won. So everybody is going to get a prize. And that is a most marvelous parable about the way things are with us and God. Everybody gets a prize. And everybody wins. Because for God, there can never be a second and a third and a fourth. we're all number one. And we're all winners. But you've got to join the race. And so, if you want to know what that race in life is and how you get the prize, which is the vision of the beatific vision of God, how do you explain it? The best way to explain it is to do it. So it's by getting on and living the life, saying the prayers, the sacraments and the rest. Do it. Then you see the point. So that's the video then, is the story of these two children, two child actors. And of course, as everyone knows, you must never, never act with a child or a dog. But that was all right. So they steal the show. So you see these children hiding, and I hide with them. And when you found the person, then you remain behind. And so to give you an example, the boy's called Barney, and the girl's called Kate. When Barney hides under the desk, and I come in and I find Barney, I go and sit in an armchair while Kate is still looking for us. And I meditate on the telephone because my experience is prayer is, it's like telephoning God. And the problem with God is he hasn't got a voice. And so when you telephone him, that is when you pray to him, you don't seem to get any reaction. And so you go on to say, well, what's the point of talking to him if he doesn't answer? So at that point, I have to bring in an example from my Auntie Betty. And my Auntie Betty was very deaf. And my Auntie Betty thought that the telephone was a very bad invention. And when she answered the telephone, she held it there in case it blew up. But you had to speak to her on the phone from time to time to show affection, to show interest. So you rang up Auntie Betty, and you talked, and you talked, and you talked, and she never answered. Just like God, she never answered. But, every Christmas, I got a box of chocolates from Auntie Betty. And I wouldn't have got that box of chocolates if I hadn't rung up regularly. Then I had to examine my conscience and say, am I just ringing her up to get those box of chocolates? And so it is with prayer. Am I doing it to please Auntie Betty? Am I doing it to please God? Or am I doing it to get something out of him? Purify my motives. But I also know, whatever my motives are, that if I talk to him and he doesn't answer, I know that something will be given to me somewhere along the line, maybe at Christmas. So there are various situations in which the children hide and then I find them. So that's the story. And it ends up with the children ready to go to bed with the mother, who was quite a young girl. We had to give her a wig to make her look older. And then I say to the children, we've had a marvelous game. It's been great fun. But don't forget that God plays hide and seek with you. And he's looking for you all the time. And you've got to let him find you. That was the moral. So that is about the video. I had to get it adapted for your own television, which is different to ours. And so I have an absolute horror of a nightmare, but it'll be very good for my humility if the whole thing hasn't come out at all. But I'm sure you'll find something else to do. The best way to explain it is to do it. That's the secret of the spiritual life. You don't do it because you understand it. You do it, and then you begin to understand something about it. When I was asked to come and speak and noticed that I was to speak for about an hour and a half, I nearly had a fit. And I said to the organizers, I've never in my life spoken more than 35 minutes. As I've now taken up the large part of what this 25 minutes already, what time's supper? Anyway, I'll go on till I think you can't take it anymore. Three words have come to be more and more important as far as I'm concerned. The idea of a pilgrim, the idea of seeking, the idea of exploring. I see myself as a pilgrim through life, seeking God. That's a very monastic phrase. And as one seeks, one tries to explore. And that is so for all of us. But I found increasingly as the years have gone by, I have this question always in my mind, what is God like? That's what I want to know. That's what I think we all want to know. And I can remember in monastic life as a novice, reading books about the spiritual life. I found them excruciatingly boring because they tended to tell me what I must do, what I must not do. And still the question remained, what is God like? That's what I want to know. And in my present job, one has to deal with all sorts of problems about the church, administration, social justice, all frightfully important, of course. Morality, euthanasia, the lot. How we behave, how we relate. But still the question haunts. What is God like? If you think I have the answer, then I think you better leave now. But I think it is the answer, certainly, that we all want to know. So, as a pilgrim through life, I imagine myself sometimes sitting by the roadside and I give it to you now, the story of Bartimaeus, because perhaps sometime in the course of today you might quietly go away, find a quiet corner, and just read Mark 10:46. They came to Jericho, and as he was leaving Jericho with his disciples, a great multitude and Bartimaeus, a blind beggar, the son of Timaeus, was sitting by the roadside. And when he heard that it was Jesus of Nazareth, he began to cry out and say, Jesus, son of David, have mercy on me. Many rebuked him, telling him to be silent, but he cried out all the more, son of David, have mercy on me. Jesus stopped and said, call him. And they called the blind man, saying to him, take heart, rise, he's calling you. Throwing off his mantle, he sprang up and came to Jesus. And Jesus said to him, what do you want me to do for you? The blind man said to him, Master, let me receive my sight. And Jesus said to him, go your way. Your faith has made you well. Immediately he received his sight and followed him on the way. It's wonderful prayer just to kneel and to say, listen to those words being whispered into your ear. What would you want me to do for you, Lord, that I may see? At Our Lady's shrine in France, Lourdes. There's a way of approaching the grotto. You come down a zigzag path. Halfway down that zigzag path, there's a wonderful bronze of Bartimaeus kneeling with his stick and looking out over a beautiful valley. But he can't see anything. He's blind. And there's an inscription around the base of that bronze of an Italian lady who arrived to pray that she might receive her sight, have her sight restored. And she put up the statue because her sight was not restored, but her inner sight was. She got back her faith. And that's what we pray for when we say, Lord, that I may see. It's that seeing which faith, whatever way faith could let us see, that understanding, that's what we're praying for. And so with you, my prayer today is, Lord, that I may see, have a little bit of more understanding of what you are, a little more understanding of what you expect of me, that I may see. As a pilgrim going through life, sometimes you stop and you think and you ask questions about yourself. One day I was invited to give a talk to a captive audience of adolescents. If there's anything worse, it's all right if you're their teacher and you have them in class regularly, but when you're brought in from the outside and they have to do this as a kind of exercise. So this was a fairly sophisticated lot of adolescents at school. It was the school where Winston Churchill went to, so you can see that it was fairly sophisticated. And I had the foggiest notion what to speak to them about. Then I stopped and I asked myself, what are the values other than those that I receive from the gospel? What are the values which really make me reflect upon life? I wrote them down. Death, happiness, love, beauty, and truth. Those five. I've got a cold, sorry. What a very good idea. I might as well drink it out of this. Sorry about this. Oh, it's just water. How did that arise? When I look back on my life, and I remembered five situations which, now that I look back on them, I can see were very formative. I give you mine, hoping that you will look back and find yours. Five situations. This is inevitably slightly autobiographical. But when you're over 70, it doesn't matter. Because it doesn't matter what people think about you when you're over 70. Although you still wonder. So it's autobiographical. But I remember as a very small boy standing in the streets of my hometown and seeing a coffin pass. And I remember to this day saying, what is that? And being told that that was somebody who was dead, was going to be buried. And that struck me as totally absurd. I had no intention of dying, I didn't want to die. I didn't want my mother, for my father to die. It was a nonsense. even at that age, why did people die? Then, of course, with growing sophistication, one came to realize, well, good gracious, life is short. It does come to an end. The whole point of life can't surely be confined to what happens between now and the day I die. So that became, I think, a very powerful formative influence. That life is short, and that people die. Of course, at that age, I was 5 or 6, I think, I knew I wouldn't die. I discovered later on that I would. So that was an important experience. The second one, at a much later age, was having to write an essay. In those days, if you went to the university, this was long before the war, if you went to the university and did arts, then you were required to write a 3-hour essay on one word or one topic. If it was the summer holidays, that was easy. You know, we took our bucket and spade and we went to... But if it was an abstract subject, that was very difficult. It's a marvelous exercise when you're about 16 or 17 to sit down with a blank paper and write for 3 hours on a word like conversation or courage or friendship. Because you've got to write something. And as you know, when you have to write something, you have to begin thinking. And I remember a particular one we were given as a practice to write a 3-hour essay on happiness. I was about 17 years old, and I suppose it was the first time in one's life that one began to think, well, what is happiness? And are people happy? Am I happy? What's it consist of? And it seemed to be a very fickle thing. You had it today, didn't have it tomorrow. Thursday's party was blighted by Friday's dentist. And also the party that you looked forward to so much always turned out to be slightly less good than you thought. She danced with the other chap all the time. Happiness, very fickle. And yet, deep down, that's what people are looking for. Ease, well-being, peace, and the rest. So it was clear that there was not going to be happiness in this world. Completely. Complete happiness and unending happiness. Then came experience number 3. Again, age 17, 18, 16. The first time you love. Well, I don't have to tell this audience what that means, but I mean, it bowls you over. And you suddenly realize, well, my goodness, this is a pretty important thing. This is really it. And you know, of course, you come by experience to realize it too is fickle. It's not going to go on and on. And even in the idyllic couple, one will probably die before the other. So somehow or other, the coffin and death suggested, well, we don't have our lives completely be completed in this world. The happiness we're chasing and wanting is elusive. And it seems to consist, that happiness, surely, in an experience of love. So I think those three, death, happiness, and love, became subconsciously at that time very important values. Things that I wanted, things that I wanted other people to have. And then there came the fourth experience. again about the age of 17 or 18, been introduced to poetry. If you were clever and sophisticated at the age of 17, you read T.S. Eliot. He was the rage then. And if you could say that you read T.S. Eliot, you were quite something. If you said you understood it, you were even more. But those of us of a lesser league, we used to enjoy the Lakeland poets, as they call them, Wordsworth, Keats, Shelley, Coleridge, and all. Because I can remember meeting Wordsworth and discovering through his poetry the sense that God is present everywhere. I knew that from the Catechism. Where is God? God is everywhere. I say that with the best. But suddenly to find it in a poet and describing how he saw God present everywhere. And especially in that which is most beautiful. And so beauty became an important value, an icon of God, an icon of God's beauty. Of course, I know that God's lovableness, and I know that God's beauty is not entirely like ours, but ours give a jolly good hint of what it might be or probably is in God. So every experience of death, every experience of happiness, every delight in beauty, every experience of love, I'm touching the hem, as it were, of God's outer garments. The fifth one was when I was very grown up. And I was teaching young monks, teaching in the school, and trying to prove the existence of God to the young monks. They were all right until about 1961, and then they didn't like it. Life became different in the 1960s. But up to then, my proof was a wow. Then I used to teach it in the school. So I taught the proofs of the existence of God for years. But one day, I was sitting in a room crowded with kids before going down to Vespers, and I was preparing a class for the next day, and I suddenly realized what it meant. That sort of kind of light that comes, you don't know why, you suddenly realize that life without God, a world without God, is a nonsense. It's one of those things when you just see the truth. There is a God. Perhaps it's something we could discuss later on. Now all this is the pilgrim going through life. And there are the cloud of unknown above, occasionally little chinks of light, shafts of God's glory come down to help you and guide you on your way. And for me, death was one, moments of happiness another, God's beauty is another, lovableness is another. Because human love is the instrument we have to explore the reality of love, which is in God. And there's nothing more lovely than doing a wedding and you're able to say to these two, you now know, you have some idea now, don't you, of what the word love means in God. And now together, for the rest of your lives, you use your love to explore the love that's in him. He becomes the third partner. I've been going 45 minutes. Can you take any more? Well, two said yes. See, the next talk, this is the pilgrim limping through life. Very often, eyes held so that you don't see very clearly. From time to time, a shaft of light, which gives you enough energy to go on forward. But of course, what you long for is somebody to come in the opposite direction, take you by the hand, and then go on with you. That's tomorrow's talk. Because God comes in Christ to meet you and walk with you, fellow pilgrim. And that's exciting. Suppose if I just let it would stand on its own. No, it won't. I've got to turn a page. St. Paul, writing to the Romans, as you will remember, upbraided the Romans because from the things that are visible, they hadn't worked out the existence of things that were invisible. But in other words, through the creation, in different aspects of it, through the creations, the different aspects of it, something about God can be perceived. Within our reach, but beyond our grasp. That passage from St. Paul comes up, unless I'm very mistaken, its background is chapter 13 of the Book of Wisdom. Yes, naturally stupid are all who are unaware of God, and who from good things seen have not been able to discover him who is, or by studying the works have not recognized the artificer. Fire, however, or wind, or the swift air, the sphere of the stars, impetuous water, heaven's lamps, are what they have held to be the gods who govern the world. If charmed by their beauty, they have taken these for gods. Let them know how much the master of these excels them, since it was the very source of beauty that created them. And if they've been impressed by their power and energy, let them deduce from these how much mightier is he that has formed them, since through the grandeur and the beauty of the creatures, we may by analogy contemplate their author. Small blame, however, attaches to them, for perhaps they go astray only in their search for God and their eagerness to find him. Familiar with his works, they investigate them, fall victim to appearances, seen so much beauty, but even so they have no excuse. If they are capable of acquiring enough knowledge to be able to investigate the world, have they been so slow to find its master? The Book of Wisdom, chapter 13. So we are pilgrims, walking through life, seeking God, and then trying to find him, and then exploring and finding out what he's like. And there are, in our past experiences, something that has happened which has said to us, yes, I keep going on my pilgrim way. I gave you five of mine, you will have your own. When you look back and say, yes, yes, yes. I mean, it's the difference between being brought up RC, going to a RC school, going to church regularly. That's not what I mean, quite. But it's the pilgrimage of one's mind and heart. Because all those things can remain very external. But it's the journey of faith, it's the pilgrimage of faith, of seeking and trying to discover. And as I've always believed, we're made for God, obviously. And as St. Augustine said, we're restless till we rest in him. We need him. There's a great poem by George Herbert, which he describes what the gifts which God gave. Gave you this gift, that gift, intelligence, strength, and the rest. But one gift he decided to withhold, and that was rest, peace. Because he said if they had that gift too, they would never pine and be restless for him. When God had first made man, tricky that, having a glass of blessings standing by, let us, he said, pour on him all we can. Let the world's riches, which dispersed lie, contract into a span. So strength first made a way, then beauty flowed, then wisdom, honor, pleasure. When almost all was out, God made a stay, perceiving that alone of all his treasure, rest in the bottom lay. For if I should, said he, bestow this jewel also on my creature, he would adore my gifts instead of me, and rest in nature, not the God of nature. So both should losers be. Yet let him keep the rest, keep them with repining restlessness. Let him be rich and weary, that at least if goodness leads him not, yet weariness may toss him to my breast. He wants us to be restless for him. It's now 9:25. I said yesterday I couldn't speak for more than 25 minutes. I've doubled that, and I haven't finished my text. So I'm going to leave it there, reminding ourselves, yes, we're pilgrims in search. We can look back in our lives and see moments that have been important. And there's a restlessness about us, because we know that happiness lies elsewhere. The great experience of love, the greatest of all, lies elsewhere. The admiring of perfect beauty lies elsewhere. So we're going to be a little bit restless till that happens. Not only restless, but looking forward to the day of total happiness, looking forward to the day of that highest experience of love, which is the love of God, and admiring that fantastic beauty. That's what we're on the way to. That's what the pilgrim way leads to. And from time to time, you get shafts of life. Good gracious, that piano concerto, you know, that movement just gets me. Lovely moments. Or the beautiful face of a beautiful girl, let me say. Ah, that's a message from God to help me on my way, and I'm restless until I rest in God. But these are moments when the shaft of God's glory comes down through the clouds of unknown and lights me on my way. But there's a somber side. There's a lot of sin, a lot of suffering, a lot of tragedy. And in my own life, a lot of failure, a lot of darkness. Sometimes days and months of darkness. And that's why I must sit by the wayside, having said my prayer, Lord, that I may see, just to go another step further. But please, Lord, you come in my direction and tell me how to go forward. That's tomorrow. Please.
What happens when the restlessness is filled or consumed?
How the what?
What happens when the restlessness is filled or consumed? If we're restless for God,
yep.
And we seek Him, what happens when that restlessness is all of a sudden filled or consumed? Or is that possible?
Not in this world. It only happens, surely, when when we're united with God in vision. Is that right?
I don't know. Is it?
Hands up, those who know.
I was wondering, is it possible to have much of your restlessness resting in Him, united in Him in this world?
I think there can be moments. You're quite right. There can be moments when you say, like the apostles at Mount Tabor, it is good to be here. But remember, they came down from Mount Tabor and they saw only Jesus. So I think, yes, a person who has a serious prayer life can have moments of that total peace. I agree. But that is gift. That's God's gift. And most of us have to go through life sweating it out, day in, day out, going to our prayers, not looking for the God of comforts, the comforts of God, but waiting for His gift. And sometimes He gives it. And I know people to whom He's given it often. So yes, it is true. And I think those are foretastes on something very important. Yeah. Thank you for asking that. Anybody exhausted? We're looking for help.